Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We'll do some sector-by-sector news, oil, antitrust, consumers, and we will talk about making investing boring again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, everybody, the 4th of February. Good as always to have you along. A couple of notes, a couple of items as we get going here today. First of all, and it's kind of the absence of an item, actually, nothing new on talks about another virus relief plan for this economy. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen went on Good Morning America this morning, said there what she has been saying everywhere for a while now, got to go big to stop it from being worse. Later. It's worth a note on that vein that the benefits in the package that passed just before Christmas go away in March. Item number two and related, this is Thursday, so one hopes almost a year into this pandemic that all y'all know what that means. And if somehow you haven't been paying attention, Thursdays we get first-time claims for unemployment benefits. 779,000 people lost their jobs last week, down from the past couple of weeks, yes, but still staggeringly high, which I feel like I have to say every week just to remind everybody how bad it actually is. And finally, in keeping with the policy of this program that we got to keep talking about this stuff or we are going to stop talking about this stuff, the CEO of the pharmaceutical giant Merck, Kenneth Frazier is his name. He announced today he is going to be retiring come June. Frazier is one of four, count them, four Black CEOs at Fortune 500 companies, which is to say that in June, they're going to be three. We said yesterday on the program that we try real hard not to get too deep into the process weeds of this economy. That's never any fun. But process can and often does lead to policy. And so to this news. Now that there is finally a power-sharing agreement in the Senate of the United States, control of committees is changing hands, which means Democrats are now going to set the agenda for what gets talked about and voted on. And that includes a new bill using antitrust law to overhaul how the government regulates big companies. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The way it works now, for the government to block a merger or acquisition or prosecute a company for being anti-competitive, regulators use something called the Consumer Welfare Standard, says Christopher Casey, a partner at the law firm Duane Morris.
That generally focuses on whether there will be an increase in prices or a reduction in output as a result of a combination or other action.
That means the government has to prove it's bad for consumers. Casey says that's a tough standard for regulators to meet, especially now.
The economy has changed so dramatically in the past 10 years. You just look at the dominance of the tech companies in American life.
So this new legislation aims to make it easier to bring cases against big firms. Charlotte Slayman is the competition policy director at the group Public Knowledge.
So one of the things that this bill does is change those burdens of proof, change those presumptions so that we're erring more on the side of over-enforcement rather than under-enforcement.
The bill would also provide more money to bring antitrust cases and bigger fines for companies that break the rules. Spencer Waller is a professor at Loyola University Chicago School of Law.
This is among the first time in decades that antitrust has become a political issue, has been the subject of important legislation and hearings and reports.
And there seems to be some bipartisan support to update antitrust rules, not just in tech, but also in highly consolidated industries like healthcare, pharmaceuticals, and defense. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Wall Street today on the way to the end of the first full week of February. Yeah, it's all good. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I touched real briefly on oil yesterday, a bump in prices that I'd missed, higher on supply worries and hopes that maybe soonish we are going to start driving and flying and going places again. But 2020 put big oil through the ringer. ExxonMobil reported a loss all in of more than $22 billion. Royal Dutch Shell said today its profits dropped 71% last year from a year earlier. And if the pandemic wasn't enough, there is, as you know, a whole bunch of new momentum toward a less carbony future. So Marketplace's Sabri Benishore looked at the oil industry of the medium-term future.
It is not just Exxon and Shell. BP lost $5.7 billion last year. ConocoPhillips out $2.7. Chevron lost $5.5 billion. 2020 saw the steepest decline in oil demand in modern history.
They've been to hell and back.
Michael Lynch is president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research. More than 500 oil and gas-related companies declared bankruptcy last year. The survivors are taking a long, hard look at efficiency, according to Clark Sekchevsky with accounting firm BDO.
Finding the most effective way to get every molecule out of the ground.
Plus shutting down expensive wells, trimming investments in new ones. Lynch says the next few quarters should actually see modest profits.
People should be careful about thinking that the pandemic reflects a new normal.
But a very different normal is coming, a lower carbon normal. Europe has legally committed itself to being carbon neutral by 2050. The Biden administration has rejoined the Paris Climate Agreement. Dwayne Dixon leads U.S. oil, gas, and chemicals at Deloitte.
It's a transition. It's going to take a while. Nothing's going to happen overnight.
And different oil companies are getting ready for the future at different paces.
The cutting edge of this process, the first movers, are in Europe.
Pavel Molchanov is an energy analyst at Raymond James. British Petroleum, for example, has said it wants to ramp up investment in renewable energy tenfold.
The earlier companies can establish a foothold in these emerging opportunities, the better it will be, because you know, 5 years from now, it will be much more crowded and competitive.
American oil producers like Exxon and Chevron have been slower to make grand commitments, but they have time. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, here's what I want you to do. Get up tomorrow morning, get your coffee, your tea, whatever, fire up the stream, and listen to David Brancaccio in the Marketplace Morning Report. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. This is a pretty politically polarized country. Nothing new there, nothing shocking in what I just said. But what's becoming more clear with every twist and turn of our politics is that the economy is becoming more polarized too, even down to how we feel about it. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
When Donald Trump was president, Republicans were pumped about the economy. Democrats, not so much. Their consumer confidence hovered about 40 points lower.
Then all of a sudden, we saw this dramatic change with the election.
Economist John Lear tracks consumer confidence at Morning Consult.
As it became increasingly clear that Joe Biden won the presidency, confidence among Democrats skyrocketed while it fell among Republicans.
After the Democrat Senate wins in Georgia, the storming of the Capitol, and the Biden-Harris inauguration, Democrats' confidence rose to about 30 points above Republicans. Part of the reason, says Lear, Americans have become more partisan.
There's a long history of politics influencing consumers' views of the economy. There's strong evidence that the impact of politics has actually increased over time.
I found evidence of this partisan divide among Americans whom Marketplace and Edison Research have been polling for the past several years. Anna Cronin's from Phoenix. She's a Trump supporter, works for a homeowners association, and runs a small renovation company on the side.
Well, I am very, very uneasy about where we're headed.
Now that Democrats are in charge.
The level of debt that we're getting into is very concerning. We're headed to more restrictions, I think, financially. I am very concerned about raising the minimum wage because of the trickle-down effect that it's going to have on all of us.
And from the other side, here's Democrat Howard Kelly Jr. He works part-time as a PR consultant in Philadelphia.
I really think the future is bright. I mean, these last 4 years have been tough.
Kelly doesn't think his own economic prospects will necessarily improve immediately, but he thinks the overall economy will rise with new Democratic policies on COVID, job creation, and income inequality.
I just feel like everything has the potential to get better. As a consumer, you have more reasons to feel confident right now because the people that are in charge are going to be making the right moves.
The difference here is like Team Democrat all dancing in the end zone after winning the big election game, while Team GOP is bumming in the locker room after losing.
I think that there's definitely a psychological connection in political partisanship and sports partisanship.
Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College.
What can happen with sports, and it's mostly a very short-term and ephemeral phenomenon, is that optimism and energy can reverberate in the town after the team wins the Super Bowl or wins the World Series.
Zimbalist thinks political defeat or victory affects consumer confidence by altering Americans' expectations of how economic policy might change along party lines. So for Republicans 4 years ago and Democrats right now,
one begins to believe that there'll be good economic policies put in place. And that usually is going along with a greater willingness to invest in the future, spend money on short-term entertainment.
How ready consumers are to actually spend it up, though, is partly down to personal circumstances. Aaron Itteraldi voted for Trump in 2020, and he thinks the economy's in for rough going. With Democrats in control of Congress and the White House,
normally, I would definitely be drawn back as far as my expenditures and all that and be putting more into savings for, you know, like a rainy day.
But he works for an armaments factory in Kansas City, Missouri that's been going gangbusters.
With the industry that I'm in, making ammunition, all the overtime and double time that I could possibly ask for, money is not going to be an issue.
So while he's pessimistic about the country's prospects, his own economic future's looking good. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I was working at my dining room table and it really started affecting my posture.
Working from home does have some perks, yes. Not necessarily for your back, though. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 332 points today, 1%, 31,055 for the blue chips. NASDAQ added 167 points, just shy of 1.25%, finished at 13,777. The S&P 500 gained 41 points, almost 1.1%, ended things at 3,871. Tomorrow, we're going to get January's jobs numbers from the Commerce Department. Today, we got what could be a preview from payroll processor ADP, which reported that private employers in this economy added 174,000 jobs in January, way better than December's number and way better than the estimate by economists pulled by Dow Jones, too. Bond prices, well, they were down. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note. Come on, you do ask, right? Yield on the 10-year rose to 1.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. My, oh my, what a difference a week can make. GameStop, not too long ago, trading as high as $450 American dollars a share. Closed today? Well, lower. $53.50 a share down. I don't know. You figure out the percentage drop there. But it does get us to the Let's Make Investing Boring Again part of this program, as promised. Neil Irwin wrote about exactly that in the New York Times today. Neil, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me.
I want to point out, first of all, as you point out in this piece, this is not the first time that populism of a sort has come to the stock markets.
No, look, people have been arguing about stocks for a long time. There were the Yahoo message boards back in the late 90s that were very popular. You know, there have been people cornering the market and doing short squeezes and having weird technical shifts in markets for as long as there have been markets.
But there does seem to be an anger now. Do you agree?
Yeah, you know, in my reading of financial history, I don't know of a lot of instances where there's a huge swing in the market driven by people who want to, you know, take it to the powerful and really bring down the system. And we've seen a lot of that kind of almost an anarchism in some of the language and rhetoric we're hearing out of the Redditors who've driven these swings in GameStop.
Do you think, though, that some of that anger is not misplaced, if I could do the double negative, right? Because for a long time, the rich have been getting richer and the poorer have not in this economy.
Yeah, there's no question that this has been a period of widening inequality and especially wealth inequality. You know, we've had a real surge in financial market prices and asset prices over the last year and over the last many years. That benefits people who have assets. So if you started this run up with in good shape with lots of wealth, you've done pretty well. So I understand why there's a lot of people who think the system is rigged, who think it's unfair. That said, I would argue that there are ways to take advantage of that rather than think that you can somehow bring down the system by shorting a small cap stock.
Well, so let's talk about those real quick, because your basic gist in this piece is get in the market, be there for a long time, sit on your hands, and your money's going to grow.
Yeah, so this is not some new piece of kind of financial advice or personal finance advice. This is what every personal finance advice person has been saying for decades. But the math is clear cut. You know, if at any point over the last several decades you've had money to invest and just put it in an S&P 500 index fund, reinvested dividends, kept fees low, tried to avoid taxes, you've done quite well. And you have doubled or tripled your money, depending on the exact time horizon, if you had the patience to just stick it out and not overreact to swings in the market.
All right. So look, let's talk about what happens next, right? Because Secretary Yellen said this morning on Good Morning America that she's meeting with regulators to look at this. There will be hearings up and down Capitol Hill on this. Do you think there's going to be substantive regulatory change?
I mean, the weird thing is this push is coming from two different and opposite directions in Washington. Right. You have people simultaneously saying, oh my gosh, you know, how could Robinhood have shut down some stock transactions when people wanted to engage in this? People should be free to play in the market the way they want. On the other hand, you're seeing people say, well, why is no one protecting investors from themselves and potentially taking risks that really are not appropriate to their level of wealth and risk appetite? How those intersect in Congress, in the Treasury, in the SEC, I think we really don't know yet.
Neil Irwin, senior economics correspondent at The New York Times, wrote about GameStop and the underlying realities today in the paper. Neil, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
If you're working from home like millions of people are, there are certain ways you are saving money. Not buying as much gas for the car, probably, or a Metro card. Not going out for lunch or a cup of coffee. But there are certain ways you're spending money, too. Maybe a new office chair or bumping up your internet speed. And chances are you have wondered idly whether you can expense that to your boss. Turns out, as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, bosses have been wondering the same thing.
Ryan Beck got his first job out of college back in October of 2019, working for a life insurance company in the Lansing, Michigan area. At the beginning of last year, at 23, he also decided it was time to get his own apartment.
So I had spent my money on furniture and things like that.
Then in March, his boss told him and everyone else not to come into the office.
I was working at my dining room table and, I mean, gets the job done, but after, you know, a couple weeks of that, it really started affecting my posture.
That made his back hurt, and he just wasn't as productive. And then he says, out of the blue,
we got a check to help cover some of the cost.
A check from his employer. Now, it wasn't a lot of money, a little more than $100, but for him, it was
kind of like a stimulus check, and that helped me get a desk and a chair.
Beck is an outlier. A new survey from the compensation software and data company PayScale found that only 25% of organizations paid any kind of stipend to employees working from home last year. Shelley Holt heads up human resources. She says PayScale did give its employees $500 at the start of the pandemic to help with unexpected costs, but as people continue to work from home,
a stipend probably isn't the best strategy to address that. That probably needs to be a longer, more comprehensive policy. And that is something that we're trying to figure out right now at PayScale, because we do anticipate we will be moving to a hybrid environment going forward.
Holt says as companies make some level of working from home permanent, they need to think carefully about their compensation policies, because figuring out stipends can get tricky. Lonnie Golden teaches economics at Penn State University. He says, for example, there's a huge difference between an employer saying you can work from home versus that you must.
If they are making the work required to be done remotely, one would think that that expense should be picked up wholly or at least partly by the employer.
But there's a lot of gray area here. Like, can a worker expense an electricity bill during a heat wave if they're running the AC while they're working at home?
This area is, I think, going to be seeing a lot more litigation.
Elliot Siegel is a partner at King & Siegel, an employment law firm in Los Angeles. He says cell phones or wireless contracts have become the thing that employers will often help workers pay for, assuming they use their phone for work. But he thinks the pandemic has forced employers to rethink what qualifies as expensable.
You could argue that essentially any cost that you incur at home has to be in some way apportioned and taxed back to the employer.
Whether you can charge your employer for part of your internet bill or get them to pay for a new printer, well, those aren't big concerns for Matt Ivalotis. He works in cybersecurity for the credit card processing company CardX. He lives outside of Chicago and says he's saving plenty of money working from home.
$210 a month on train fare, $55 on bus, $40 for parking, and then the little things you don't think about in terms of how much of our spending was habitual based on sort of the routine of the day.
The coffee at Starbucks and lunch across the street from the office. He feels like he's making out like a bandit and also recognizes that he's in a privileged position just to be able to work from home. A study from the University of Washington found that about 75% of Americans can't work from home. Folks working in healthcare or at the grocery store, among so many others. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Yes, the Super Bowl is mostly about football, fine. But there is no small part of Sunday that's really going to be about the food. Nachos and chicken wings and beer. And the bars and restaurants that are known for and usually make a whole lot of money on that particular game day are in for a complicated weekend, what with in-person dining restrictions in flux around much of the country. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab talked to some business owners about how they think Super Bowl Sunday is going to go down.
Forget the intricate plays happening on the field. Jim Friss is focused on his team in the kitchen.
It's mass chaos, 4 to 6:30.
Friss owns PJW Restaurant Group, which has a bunch of sports bars in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. He says takeout now makes up the majority of his business on game days, but he still expects his restaurants to be as busy as they can be, even on the outside.
And you're looking in at, you know, 75-inch TVs, it's not hard to see.
He says a lot of customers stream the audio on their phones. It won't be the usual party, but Friss is just happy New Jersey is extending its curfew past 10 p.m. 10 will still be the rule in parts of Minnesota and New Mexico. Hopefully the game doesn't go into overtime. Indoor dining is closed in most of Washington state. Anthony Antone at the Washington Hospitality Association says he's seeing lots of catering specials, even from restaurants with food you might not associate with the Super Bowl.
Thai food, Korean food. I love the idea of food from around the world for your Super Bowl snacks.
Still, nothing will get in the way of some sports lovers and their traditional Super Bowl, even if they must sit outside. Jennifer Kay is with Eat, Drink, Be Merry, which has 8 sports bars in New York City. On Sunday, staff will wheel out the TVs. Think those AV carts your grade school teacher brought in on movie day. Kay says it's really for their regulars. Game days aren't what they used to be.
It's not just like we've been closed for 13 weeks of football. We're coming up on a year, you know, sporadically being open with percentages and taking weather into account, all those things. Football is just one small piece of that puzzle.
On Sunday, there will be spiked hot cider and electric heaters. But in the end, she says, it'll just be another day of doing business during a pandemic. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today from the Marketplace desk of You Can't Fire Me, I Quit. You might have heard that SAG-AFTRA, the union that represents, among other people, movie and television actors, has been looking into disciplining or expelling former President Trump for his role in the events leading up to January the 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol. Mr. Trump had been a member of the union in light of his film and TV appearances over the years. Anyway, he sent a letter to SAG after it today, typically Trumpian in style and content, which ended, and this is a quote, "This letter is to inform you of my immediate resignation from SAG after you have done nothing for me," end of quote. SAG-AFTRA's response, and this is also a quote in its entirety, "Thank you." All right, we got to go, but here is your Thursday moment of economic context. It comes to us courtesy of the Bank of England today. The bank held interest rates steady this morning, right down near zero, much as the Federal Reserve here has done. But the B of E did say, and this would be interesting if it happened, it said that it wants banks over there to be ready for negative interest rates, where those banks would have to pay the central bank to hold their excess capital, their excess deposits. The theory being that that would incentivize those banks out in the system to lend that money out to investors, get it out into circulation, and thus boost the economy. No sign it is imminent, but it would be big, big, big central bank news. Jay Powell, for what it's worth, has said, yeah, thanks, no, not interested. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.